Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine publishes original crime and mystery fiction in 6 double issues a year. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. In our podcast series, we bring you readings of short stories from the back issues of our magazine to give you a sense of what the magazine is about. For this episode, Susan Breen reads her story, Detective Anne Boleyn, from our May-June 2022 issue. Susan Breen is the author of Maggie Dove and the Lost Brides, the third in her series featuring the eponymous Sunday school teacher and private detective, and set in the bucolic Hudson River Valley.
It all started when I dropped dead in the Tower of London. Not that I understood at first what was happening. A sense of flight and dislocation, the press of damp wood against my face, and then a woman's foot kicking against my back. Some years earlier, a woman sat on me on a train, just like that, sat down right on top of my lap, and when I complained and asked her to please move to her own seat, she looked at me puzzled, like there was something remarkable about a middle-aged woman having something to say. She didn't move. Lucky for me, she got off at the next stop. This woman saw me, however. This woman tripped over me and then started to scream, "Oh my God, oh my God, she's dead." My family had moved on ahead of me. They'd wanted to see King Henry VIII's massive suit of armor, whereas I'd moved to the side toward a window to get away from the crowd. So it took a few minutes, what with all the phones flashing and people screaming in consternation, for them to make their way back to me, my husband and my son and my new daughter-in-law, Zara. That was when I started to panic, when I saw their tears. Up until then, I'd assumed I was having one of my daydreams. But when I saw my boulder of a husband looking down at me and shuddering with grief, my son wrapping his arms around him, and even Zara looking frightened, that was when I knew something terrible had happened. I tried to talk, but no words came out of my mouth. I wanted to yell, felt panic rising inside me like a bird trapped in an attic, ricocheting against my insides. I fought it down, turned my head, and it was then that I saw Anne Boleyn walk into the room. I knew her immediately. I'd always been interested in her and watched that TV show about the Tudors over and over again, though it seemed to me it dropped off after Anne died. Who cared about Prissy Jane Seymour or wilted Anne of Cleves or doomed Catherine Howard or the virtuous Catherine Parr? How could anyone compete with Anne Boleyn, who changed the world because of how she loved? The most visible woman in the world, thought I, a woman so invisible as to be sat upon. This Anne Boleyn wasn't as pretty as the one on TV. She was thinner and her skin more sallow. Her dress was plainer than I would have expected, a simple black gown and a white cap that covered her hair. But around her neck was that famous necklace, the bee that dripped with pearls, and she carried a slender book in her hands. She stood for a moment in the middle of the tumult, and then she did something remarkable. She looked at me, right at me, as though there were no one in that room except for the two of us. Then a guard ran through her, holding a set of defibrillators. He ran to where I lay, the paddles sizzling and humming. I was terrified he would do something that hurt. It had always been my nightmare to wake up in the middle of surgery. Automatically, I twisted myself away from him. And to my surprise, I twisted myself right out of my body. There I stood, a shadow of myself. No one seemed to notice, except for Anne Boleyn. And so I walked over to her, or perhaps better to say I glided over to her. I felt so strange, so weightless. My knees didn't hurt at all. "Do you see me?" I asked her. "Oui," she answered, in a soft French accent. "You are in front of me." "But how?" I asked, not certain how to put into words what I feared. Around us, a crowd of tourists murmured, pushed to the side by the beefeaters who were ordering them to stay put until the police arrived. One brassy-looking woman complained loudly. "You are a ghost," Anne Boleyn said. "I've seen many ghosts since I've been in the tower. The two little princes come to me every night. They tell me my grandfather killed them, which he might have done. The Howards are a cold people, and my grandfather coldest of all."
"And you were a ghost, too."
"No," she snapped, "I'm not dead." Now this I knew could not be true, because I'd watched that harrowing scene in the Tudors when she got her head chopped off. The necklace must cover the wound. She was as dead as anyone could be, yet all I could find in me to say was, "Are you sure?" She didn't so much reply as bristle, clearly a subject she did not want to discuss, which I respected. I could see how it would be embarrassing to have your husband kill you in order to marry another woman. She reminded me a little of my friend Elaine Spengler, who told everyone in the neighborhood that her husband's cousin had come to live with them, though everyone knew perfectly well that that woman was not his cousin. I suppose we all dealt with that reality as best we could. "Do you know who poisoned you?" Anne Boleyn asked. That jolted me back to reality, or unreality. "No one poisoned me," I replied. "I must have had a heart attack. I remember feeling strange when I walked up the stairs. Dizzy, you know? Lightheaded, and my arm hurt. My mother died of a heart attack when she was around my age." "Have you accepted gloves from someone you don't know?"
"Of course not. Why would anyone give me gloves? It's May."
She narrowed her eyes at me. I thought of the ravens we'd seen on our tour of the tower just an hour earlier, a clutch of them in a little cage, hopping around, staring at irritation with everyone who walked by. My son laughing at them, my dear son, Luke, who had paid for this trip to England so we'd have a chance to meet his new wife. He'd created a new life for himself in Los Angeles, so far away from where my husband and I lived in New York.
"You must have an enemy," Anne Boleyn said. "All royals have enemies."
"I'm not royal. I'm just plain old Kit Fargo of East Meadow, Long Island, New York, United States. That's it."
"Then why are you wearing purple?" she snapped. "Only royalty is allowed to wear purple."
I looked down and saw that I had on my purple sweatpants. I owned a lot of them because I'd bought them during a sale at Kmart. I always bought multiple volumes of things, because then, if you got behind on your laundry, you could mix and match. Not that I thought Anne Boleyn would be interested in my laundry sorting technique. Even I was not as oblivious as all that.
"I remember the first time I was allowed to wear purple," she said. "It was on the day I became Marquess of Pembroke. I was with child. My king was so happy. He was so certain it would be a boy. He swore he would love me until the end of time." She paused. I'd had a dog growing up who paused just like that when he saw a bigger dog. Then he'd lunge. Tino, that rare golden retriever with attitude. My husband, at the time my boyfriend, used to come over to my house and play catch with Tino for hours. Summer afternoons filled with laughter and love. He was captain of the football team. I was valedictorian. Brian got a football scholarship to college, dreamed of going pro, but tore his ACL on his first week on campus. Had to drop out. Got a job at Caldor's. We married. I got pregnant. He rose up through the ranks until Caldor's went bust. Started up his own business. Struggled. Got into a car accident. It was his fault, sort of. Got sued. Hurt his back. Went on disability. My mother moved in with us. I'd been working as a substitute English teacher, a job I loved, that it was impossible to continue. Seemed like we just staggered from one trouble to the next, the two of us clinging to each other like survivors on a raft, loving each other, for better or worse. Where was Tino? Why was I with Anne Boleyn instead of my dog? I'd always thought one of the consolations of death would be that you'd be reunited with the dog of your youth. How many times had I fantasized about him running toward me, tongue hanging out, eyes wet with love? What did any of this have to do with poison? "Where's heaven?" I cried out. But Anne Boleyn just shrugged in the most French of ways and directed herself toward my body. She walked with little mincing steps that made it look like she was floating. She hovered for a moment over my corpse, looking down at it intently. I felt so vulnerable. In life, I'd taken such care to hide myself, to wear loose clothing, to stand behind my husband or in a corner, to avoid having people do just what she was doing, look at me carefully, judge me, mock me, and how much weight I'd put on, and how I'd aged. Meanwhile, a police officer brushed through me, a handsome man who looked like he could be cast as a police officer in a TV show. He, too, stood by my body and began questioning my husband, who looked like he was going to explode. Brian's fatal flaw. From how many soccer games had he been ejected? He was a passionate man with no boundaries. "It is as I thought," Anne Boleyn cried out. "You've been poisoned. Come here, Mistress Kit. Come look." "No." The last thing I wanted to do was look at my body. My face, slack-jawed, plain, middle-aged. I remembered the bra I'd put on that morning with the loose straps, so certain it didn't matter, so certain no one would see. I'd not let my husband see me without my clothes for years. He said I looked beautiful, but I knew he would be disappointed if he could actually see me. Not until that exact moment did it occur to me that I'd actually wanted to be invisible, that I could put up with the occasional woman sitting on me if it didn't mean people mentioning how far I'd fallen from how I used to look. "You must come here," Anne Boleyn shouted, her voice cutting through all the noise around us. "It's arsenic, I'm sure. Look at the drool on your lips, your red and swollen face. You must have eaten it in the last hour or so. A large dose to kill you so fast, though I don't see how that could have got past your poison taster. He must have been completely incompetent. Unless he, too, is dead, of course." "I have no poison taster." "No taster? Did you not defend yourself at all? No horn of a snake on your table? No sweating knife?" "No and no," I shouted back, our voices seeming to cut right through the muted hum of the crowd around us. I turned away from her, feeling flustered and anxious, and there in front of me was King Henry's armor, which, before my death, had been so surrounded with people it had been impossible to see. I hadn't been all that interested in it, so when my family said that they wanted to push their way in, I'd excused myself and raced downstairs to the Armory's cafe. It wasn't that I was hungry precisely, but I'd seen a display of fresh-made scones, and we were in England, and I wasn't likely to come back. This was all a once-in-a-lifetime trip, paid for by my son. And it said they had real Devon cream, and I so desperately wanted to try it. And I knew if I mentioned it, everyone would get that solemn look that meant they thought I should really be eating a fruit salad, which of course I should be. Now, though, Henry's armor glared in front of me in all its icy silver. The man was a mountain. Brian was big, but this man was gigantic, and he stood, legs parted, elbows askew. This true life version of him was so much larger than the actor on the TV show. What must it have felt like to have been loved such a man, and then to have him kill you? Something ran through me that must have been pity, and I turned back to Anne Boleyn, who was just then rising from my body. She rose back to a standing position. Her posture was incredible, as though pulled upright by an invisible string. Only her dress billowed around her. Plain as it was, it must have been made with one of the finest silks in the world. "It's hard to be certain," she went on, "because arsenic is odorless and tasteless. If you want to be sure, we would have to take out your organs and grind them on the shaved skin of a rabbit." "I want to do no such thing," I cried out. "That's ridiculous. No one has poisoned me. No one has fed me arsenic. No one has any reason at all to kill me." "What about your husband?" My husband stood across from me in his blue Yankees jersey and cargo pants and white socks and size 13 sneakers. My son Luke was tugging on his sleeve, something we'd all had to do from time to time to calm him down. He was a blustering man, but not a cruel one. My husband would not kill me, I said. He loves me. Look at him now, how he mourns for me. She laughed at that, a mirthless laugh. And for the first time, I saw that she was really dead. I could see the outlines of her bones under her skin. You cannot trust a man's words. He may love you one day, and the next day his attention is caught by someone new, by some pretty little tidbit who promises him children, and then none of his words mean anything. He's not like that, I said, and I meant it. He wasn't a romantic man, didn't give me presents, but he was there for me. You cannot trust anything they do, she said. And I thought, in that moment, of how her husband had betrayed her. Look, I understand you've been burned. Burned, she said, and stepped back. For the first time, she looked frightened. No, no, not like that, not really. I just mean you've been hurt. I understand that. Your husband was a monster. It wasn't your fault. But my husband's not like that. He loves me. I'm sure of it. Though even as I said those words, I found myself thinking of a recent episode of Dr. Phil and poor Elaine Spengler and her husband. But no, I thought, looking at my husband's face, the one unchanging part of my life, I wouldn't believe it. The woman with the brassy hair was yelling at her husband. They were arguing because they had tickets to see the crown jewels, VIP tickets, which had cost £50, and now they were going to lose them. And he assured her that they would give her a refund, but she was beside herself. £50, I thought, wondering what Brian would have to say if I told him I'd spent £50 on something so foolish. I hadn't wanted to tell him about the £3 for the scone, but he'd never have hurt me. He was not an abusive man. He absorbed each wound like a Pillsbury doughboy. Was it possible to imagine him killing me? Could I be that wrong? Two men ran by just then in orange jackets carrying a stretcher. Coroner, their jacket read. They were there to carry me off. Would I be autopsied? Would I have to follow my body? When they buried me, when I go underground? What were the rules and who was there to tell me beyond Anne Boleyn? And her attention was completely on my husband, who was in the midst of an argument with the police officer. It's just standard procedure, the police officer was saying. Whenever someone dies in a public place, they have to be autopsied. It's British law. I don't care whose law it is. No one is going to touch my wife. Now, sir, I don't care about your foreign rules, Brian shouted. Get me the American embassy. A passionate man, Anne Boleyn observed. She ran her hand through her hair. Her little pink tongue darted back and forth. Was this she-ghost going to make a play for my husband? A man who sired a strong son, she whispered approvingly. Then she looked at me. A man like that might want more sons. Perhaps he's become enamored of your son's wife. Perhaps her child is by him. Sir John Seymour did something similar with his own daughter-in-law. He had two sons with her until she died. What are you talking about? Her baby, she said. Her baby must be his. Zara's pregnant? I looked over to Zara, who clung to Luke's arm as tightly as she had the whole trip. She was a dentist with perfect little teeth, and I was afraid to smile when I was with her, so I felt afraid to be with her. She and Luke were so fit and hydrated, and my own shame had silenced me. I wanted to get to know her, but felt shy. What had I to say to a woman such as that? Can't you see? Anne Boleyn said. I didn't see anything, and yet I believed her. Anne Boleyn's life revolved around pregnancy, died because she could not bear a son. I felt certain that if Anne Boleyn said my daughter-in-law was pregnant, that she was. And yet I couldn't believe it. Felt my knees buckle. Felt something scrape the back of my throat. A grandchild. How I had dreamed of having a grandchild. But Luke had been so insistent that he didn't want any spawn, as he'd put it. After so many years, I'd given up hoping. Instead, I'd taken to writing letters to the grandchild I dreamed of having. Elaine Spengler laughed about it, but I found it healing. In fact, I'd written to her so much that I'd come to think I did have a grandchild. I'd named her Sally. Felt certain she'd be a girl with freckles and red hair, and she'd come to my house and we'd bake cookies and read mysteries, and I'd watch over her and protect her from all the things that might go wrong in life. How could someone take that joy away from me? For the first time, the enormity of what Anne Boleyn had been saying hit me. I had been murdered. Someone had taken my life away from me. It wasn't much of a life, but it was mine, and I liked it, and I would have been a grandmother, and I would have loved it. My body shook with fury. Years of being passive and uncomplaining drifted away, to be replaced by an emotion that was sharp and hot. I had to know who did this to me. How would the poison have got inside me, I demanded. Anne Boleyn wrapped her arms around her, causing her book to drop from its chain, like a hung man. Sometimes through touch, but more commonly through food. When would I have eaten it? Would I notice? It would look like sugar or flour. You wouldn't taste it, though you might notice it. What have you eaten? What had I eaten? Where to begin? I told her about how I'd gone down to the hotel buffet by myself before we set out for the Tower of London so that I could have some sausage because Luke was a vegan. Then, a little later, I'd gone back down to the buffet with the family and had some cereal. Then we got to the White Tower, and I'd seen the Armory's Cafe and gone in to try a scone. And I'd had some minced pie, too, because I knew we were going to see the crown jewels, and who knew how long that would take, and because I was so hungry and loved food so much. She nodded. Yes, I frequently have 7 courses for breakfast. Did you see anyone near you? No. In fact, I'd purposely tried not to see anyone. I didn't want anyone watching me or judging me, and so I'd sat behind a pillar so as not to be seen with my plates of food. And of course, as always happens, someone sat down alongside of me. It's like when you park in an empty parking lot and someone always pulls in right alongside you, and invariably they smash their doors into yours. This man was annoying, too. Knocked right into me when I reached for my tea. It was irritating, but I had apologized and scooted over to make more room for him. Why had I apologized? Just then I heard him cough, a distinctive rattling cough, which had been another thing that annoyed me. If you're sick, should you really sit down next to someone? I looked to the source of the sound and noticed him toward the edge of the crowd of the bystanders, looking over toward my body, which was now being covered up and put in a body bag. What do you see? Anne Boleyn asked, startling me. I hadn't realized she was paying attention, was so used to being unobserved. I pointed in his direction. That man sat next to me when I was having a scone. Is he one of the princes of your kingdom? There was no point in discussing the royalty issue anymore, so I stuck to the matter at hand. No, I don't know him at all. She looked at him closely. He reminds me of Thomas Cromwell, a thirsty man, a man who would do anything for money. Look how he watches you. She was right. He looked at my body as a snake might contemplate a rabbit, with a certain amount of sullen interest, appraising, calculating. Anne Boleyn glided over to him and sniffed his hands. I thought arsenic didn't smell. No, she said. But hate does. Hate, I thought. Why should this man hate me? Perhaps he was a psychopath, or Jack the Ripper come back from the dead. She pulled away from him, shook her head. But then I noticed him turn toward another man, standing deeper into the crowd. Another unknown man? But this man looked agitated. He sweat with agitation, huge blotches swelling out from under his arms onto his light blue shirt. He looked like someone had tried to poison him. He looked guilty. And then his wife began to yell at him. It was the woman with the brassy hair, the one who kept complaining about missing the private tour of the crown jewels. She was one of those oppressively annoying people who spread unhappiness everywhere. My mother had been a bit like that, which was why I'd always tried to be the opposite. "Is she your sister?" Anne Boleyn asked. "No, good grief, she looks nothing like me." "She does, and she's wearing the same royal purple." I looked at the woman more closely. She wore more makeup than I did. She wore a huge diamond ring. But we both had fair skin and short brown hair, though hers was highlighted, and I suppose you could make an argument, if you weren't paying much attention, that we looked similar, if you were the sort of person who thought most middle-aged women were alike. Something horrible roiled inside me. "Do you think he meant to kill her, and he killed me by mistake?" "I've never heard of that," Anne Boleyn said. She seemed dumbstruck. I'd managed to shock Anne Boleyn. "It can't be," I whispered, though I knew it could be, that it probably was, that it was just the sort of thing that would happen to me. No one killed Anne Boleyn by mistake. She was visible, fierce, one of a kind, hated at the end, but ferociously loved also. When that sword came down on her, no one was in any doubt that she was the target. But I'd gone to so much trouble to make myself invisible. I'd been afraid of being seen, had wanted safety above all, had dreaded being looked upon. And I'd succeeded so well that I was killed by mistake. It was so cruel, so wrong, and it was all my fault. If I had stood up for myself, if I had seized my life the way I should have, the way Anne Boleyn had, then I might be cradling my grandchild in my arms instead of lying there dead by mistake. I howled with frustration. My voice reverberated around the weathered stone walls of the White Tower. The room echoed with my fury. My entire being swelled with it. "Alors," Anne cried out, "she hears you." "Who?" "The child." I stopped shouting and followed her gaze toward my daughter-in-law, who slumped alongside my son in her bright pink Lululemon clothes. Underneath the tight little running top, under which I could see something. Nothing clearly defined, except for two bright eyes that seemed to peer at me. My granddaughter, hovering, as I was, at the intersection of life and death. For this brief moment of time, we occupied the same space. All my yelling must have jolted her out of her prenatal slumber. I drifted over to her and put my hand on Zara. She moved toward me. "Little Sally." "Luke," Zara cried out, "the baby's kicked." My slender son wrapped his arms around his wife. "Oh, I wish my mother was here to see this. She would have loved this baby." "I wrote to you," I whispered to my granddaughter. "I had so many things I wanted to tell you, and it's in a notebook in my house, under a floorboard in my bedroom. Will you remember to look for it when you're older?" She blinked. There was so much more I wanted to say, but I was cut off because just then everyone started to move. I realized then they were following my body. Should I follow too? Would I wind up at the morgue, watching myself be dissected? Or would a circle of light appear that would beam me up to heaven? That's what happened in the movies. There were always answers in the movies. You didn't just stand in the Tower of London with Anne Boleyn and wait for God to show up. Surely my life and death wasn't some cosmic joke. "This is too much," a woman yelled, and it wasn't me, but rather my twin, my lucky twin, the one who lived. She was so aggrieved for a woman who had escaped being murdered by inches, though of course she didn't know. She had no idea how much her husband must hate her. And there she was, still going on about that 50 pounds, a disagreeable woman. And yet I found myself sympathizing with her, maybe because she reminded me a bit of my friend Elaine Spengler, who could fly off into furies for the least reason, but was so good-hearted she'd shovel the snow off your walkway if she knew your back hurt. She just didn't have an off switch. That was why her husband's so-called cousin had come to live with them, or so he said. That was when I noticed this woman's husband gesture to the assassin. A slight flicker of his hands, but I noticed it, and I realized then that having got away with my murder, he was going to try again. I heard the doors to a van slam. They must have loaded my body into the coroner's van. If two middle-aged women should die of heart attacks on the same day in the Tower of London, would anyone notice? Queen Anne, I said, they're going to try to kill her again. She shrugged. She seemed to have lost energy over the course of the afternoon. She looked translucent. She'd opened up her book and was reading the words out loud. We have to stop them, I said. By now, everyone was heading out of the White Tower, talking about lunch or the crown jewels. A blast of sweet May air hit me. I smelled green grass, heard water trickling. That must be from the Anne Boleyn Memorial, right outside. Beyond all that, London, my granddaughter, my family. Instinctively, I moved toward the door. No, Anne cried, her voice suddenly raspy. Once you leave here, you can't come back. I don't want to come back, I said. It was a gloomy, dark place, full of armor and death. I want to save that woman. How? She asked. Anne Boleyn asking me for advice. I don't know. We'll have an inspiration. Who knows what sort of powers we have? I just know I can't leave her to her fate. They had moved some yards ahead of us to the walkway that led to the crown jewels. Who knew how much time that poor woman had? Anne Boleyn shook her head, which seemed to list very slightly at her motion. I cannot leave this place. He is coming for me here. That surprised me. You're waiting for King Henry to come? She began fiddling with her necklace. Her long fingers looked like spiders as they moved across her neck. He promised me he would see me again. If I can but see him again, I can win him back to me. I will have a son next time. I'm sure of it. I remembered that horrifying scene in the Tudors right before the executioner tied the cloth over her eyes. She'd stood on the scaffold right near where we stood now. She seemed calm, and yet she kept turning her head and looking backward, as though expecting a giant man on a horse to come running toward her, to pardon her, to rescue her. She must not have believed up until that last moment that her husband would truly go through with the execution. He had changed the entire religion of his country, so that he could marry her. For 7 long years, she had protected her virginity. 7 years against one of the most demanding and most powerful men in the world. How could she possibly believe he would destroy her? She had waited 7 years for him. Was 500 years that much longer? In the scheme of things? I'm so sorry, I said, but he's not coming. He's long dead, and he was buried with his next wife, Jane Seymour. Oh, how cruel the words were, yet they were the truth, and I'd come to realize the power in truth. She swung her hand to slap me, though she didn't connect. I felt air pass through me. He loved me. Yes, he did, I said. Your love for each other is one of the great stories in history. Even in my time, people are moved by it. But something happened to him. He changed. Maybe it was because he fell off that horse and hit his head. You know about that? She cried out. It did not feel like the moment to try to explain the Tudors on Showtime. I know, I said. And I know he went on to marry 4 other women after you. He killed another one of them. 4, she said. But you are the one everyone remembers, I went on. You were so fierce and brave. And your daughter went on to become the most famous queen in England. People still say she was the best ruler in all of British history. You were remembered and loved. People still leave flowers on your grave. People make fun of him, but they admire you. I don't know what's coming next, I said. But don't you want to leave here and see? Haven't you hated him long enough? She turned her face toward a small window on the far wall, which I knew looked over to a patch of green lawn where she had been executed. Something shadowy flickered over her face. What tragedy had she witnessed in those terrible few days? Her brother killed, 4 of her friends killed, all the blood and horror. Maybe that was too much to walk away from. Maybe she would be swept up in the reverberations of that horror for all eternity. And yet, suddenly, Anne Boleyn grinned. I was surprised to see she had slightly crooked teeth. And yet when she smiled, her whole face changed. She looked triumphant. She looked as she must have looked on that long ago day when she first caught Henry's attention, when she was a stunning young woman with the courage to try to capture a throne, when she was the most visible woman in the world. "Alors," she said, "you're right, Mistress Kit. We must catch this killer." Then she did something that stunned me. She held out her hand to me, Kit Fargo, a woman once so invisible as to be sat upon. My heart thumped. I felt like a kettle drum. I imagined my granddaughter dancing to its beat. Sunlight blossomed in front of us. I didn't know what would happen next, but I was excited to see. A granddaughter to love, a killer to catch, boundless possibilities. For just a moment, we paused on the threshold of the White Tower. Then Anne Boleyn and I moved through the door into the light.
Thank you, Susan Breen, for this reading of Detective Anne Boleyn from the May-June 2022 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find essays on writing by our authors at our blog, traceevidence.net. That's trace-evidence.net. This podcast was produced with the help of our managing editor, Jackie Sherbo, and editorial assistant, Kevin Wheeler. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.